That's me playing.
That sounds pretty good.
Man, not bad, huh?
The person you are hearing playing is Buddy Rich. He was born 100 years ago today. Welcome to the 1917 podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Ryan. Joining me as always is Vinny Nardiello.
Ahoy hoy, Jeff.
Ahoy hoy. Ahoy hoy kind of sounds like scatting, which is appropriate for this sort of music. What happened to band leaders being drummers? I like that.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, I always looks weird when the drummer is doing vocals and they have like the mic there. It looks odd to me.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how Don Henley and Phil Collins do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Phil Collins stops drumming when he sings.
Yeah, he doesn't usually. He'll sit in. He'll drum a little bit, but he doesn't drum the whole time.
Yeah. You know, I said I like drummers as band leaders, but I couldn't think of many. But the only bands I'm thinking of right now, I'm thinking of the Max Weinberg Seven. I'm thinking of Questlove and the Roots. The drummers are the band leaders.
Yeah.
So I don't know where in my head I thought that drummers stopped doing that. But I guess it's wrong. I like this music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is great stuff.
I think it seems okay live to me. I don't think I like sit around listening to it.
It's very energetic.
Yeah, I don't know. I just picture like making nervous when you drive
it. It does sound like a heart attack.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is music to do a cocaine montage to.
You're off mic.
This is music to do a cocaine montage to.
Yeah. There's certain songs that are just like when would I listen to this? I can't do a drive. I'm not going to relax at home listening to the, you know, drumming.
Yeah. How did you feel about Whiplash?
I liked it.
You did?
Yes.
I had a friend who was a drummer, and he couldn't stand Whiplash. And I think that's because when you're actually in the industry of what's being filmed, you're aware of everything that they get wrong.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's been a ton of shows about stand-up comedy over the past few years now. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one thing I've never seen in real life. People don't have onstage meltdowns anywhere near as much as they do in these stand-up comedy TV shows.
Yeah.
And movies, where people like just have that one moment of like, I just gotta be honest with you people. I'm up here just trying to make you laugh. And back home, my life's in the shitter.
Yeah, I love to watch like a medical procedural where a character says, you know what, it's really strange, but this case has a parallel to my personal life. And I just want to bring it up because it's never happened before. It's so unusual and coincidental.
So what was the drumming bad in the movie? Is that how he felt?
No, he felt like the teaching was really over the top. That you didn't need to beat people up, he was basically upset with the premise of the film because it was a music educator. And Whiplash ultimately is not a music about music education.
He's not Mr. Holland.
No, it's a story about someone being pushed brutally to excellence and him being okay with being pushed brutally to excellence. Good job, Buddy Rich. Did you know that Buddy Rich is name checked in one of my favorite songs of all time, Sabotage by the Beastie Boys?
Real?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's hard to hear, but in the third verse, he says, like, I'm Buddy Rich when I fly off the handle.
In another song, What You Want,
uh-huh.
Do they mention Vincent Gardenia?
I think they do.
Yeah.
I think they do. There's a lot of obscure pulls.
There's a line in there that definitely sounds like Vincent Gardenia. And I've always sung it as Vincent Gardenia. And I know I can easily go online and look this up,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to. I want to just go with, oh, you're saying about Vincent Gardenia.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are. The Beastie Boys were the future in that everyone now is full of pop culture references. They were making that back when you didn't do that.
Yeah, so nobody if you're listening, don't you dare tell me if it's Vincent Gardenia or not, for real.
No, I will co-sign that it's definitely Vincent
Gardenia. It's definitely, okay, great.
Absolutely. It has to be.
All right. Why Vincent Gardini? I mean, Buddy Richards is like an icon. Vincent Gardini is not an iconic actor of any
Maybe
kind.
They were big fans of Mr. Mushnick. Or from...
he was all in The Family, and he was in Moonstruck. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of possible choices for your Gardenia. But the reason why they mentioned Buddy Rich is because one of his associates started to secretly record Buddy Rich when he got super mad and yelled at people. And this became like legendary tapes that people in the
like when Bill O'Reilly was like flipping out.
Yes, yeah. Yes, this was like an early meme
or Orson Welles.
Yes, this was like the 1980s or 70s version of a viral tape. In fact, if you watch early Seinfeld episodes, Jerry Seinfeld says a lot of the Buddy Rich stuff verbatim.
Mm-hmm. Like what? What's one of the lines?
I'll look it up and cut this out. Can you smell my socks from here? Because I can smell my socks.
I can, actually. It's not good. I'm not enjoying it.
It'd be weird if you did. Okay, I found it. This is from my Hawaiian research assistant's write-up of the bus tapes from his Buddy Rich page. Buddy Rich's temper, mercurial attitude, and imposing personality were documented in secret recordings that pianist Lee Musiker made during some of his outbursts on tour buses and backstage in the early 1980s.
So his penis was named Musiker?
His penis was named Musiker. These recordings, long circulated in bootleg form, have done much to fuel the reputation of Rich's personality. The tapes were popular with comedian Jerry Seinfeld, who used three quotes from them more or less verbatim in Seinfeld. Quote number one, if I have to tell you again, we're going to take it outside. I'm going to show you what it's like. Quote number two.
I mean, that was a Costanza line.
Yeah. Quote number two, this guy, this is not my kind of guy. And number three, then let's see how he does up there without all the assistance. On one recording, Rich threatened to fire Dave Panici, a trombonist, for having a beard. While he threatened many times to fire members of his band, he seldom did, and for the most part, he lauded his magicians, his musicians, during television appearances. They're not magicians, they're illusionists. The day before Rich died, he was visited by Mel Torme, who claimed that one of Rich's last requests was to hear the tapes that featured his angry outbursts. At the time, Torme was working on an authorized biography of Rich, which was released after Rich's death titled Traps. Torme included edited excerpts of the tape in the book, but never played them for Rich.
What's your favorite celebrity meltdown recording?
Christian Bale.
You went to Christian Bale one best.
Yeah.
Why is that?
That's because I feel like Christian Bale has been railroaded, because he is clearly in character as the guy he was playing, who was a military leader. Mm-hmm. And he's acting the way that you would imagine like a tough sergeant in the army would act if someone dropped a heavy piece of equipment while he was trying to give a rousing speech, where he starts yelling at the guy, then apologizing a little bit, then yelling at him more, and then apologizing a little bit, all while in an American accent. That's the thing that no one brings up, that he's in an American accent, so he's clearly not as himself. Mm-hmm. He's in the role. So that's why it's
that's more, because you feel he's being wronged.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of ones I like. Well, Orson Welles is a classic.
Yeah.
That really is, because just the he's like reading about like frozen dinners or whatever. And
William Shatner's pretty good.
I like the O'Reilly one best for, well, two things. Number one, he's the one who keeps screwing up.
Yeah. Actually. Would the Casey Kasem meltdown count?
That one's great too. It still sounds like Casey Kasem. Yeah. Ponderous, man. Fucking ponderous. We're coming on at 2 a.m. What the? But the O'Reilly one, I like too. Because all right, so yeah, he's in the wrong. He's the one who keeps messing up the lines.
Yeah.
Play us out, man. And secondly, the way how smoothly he transitions from like angry, like, you know, abuser, mm-hmm, into just like consummate newsman.
Yeah, that's
we'll do it live. We'll do what? All right, everybody, we're gonna.
that's a sociopath right there.
Yeah,
or maybe that's just a complete professional. Have you seen the Billy Joel meltdown?
No,
it was in the 80s. He was playing in Russia in like 86, and this was the first time an American act had gone to Russia, and they were trying to make a concert film about it, and there were Russian kids that were dancing in the first couple of rows, and the film crew wanted to film it, but every time they turned on the floodlights so that they could film, everyone stopped dancing because they were, you know, scared that the Stasi or someone was going to find them and see them on tape and then kill their families. Mm-hmm. So the lights would go on, kids would stop dancing, lights would go off, kids would start dancing again. This went on like three or four times. And Billy Joel is well aware of what's going on, but he's in the middle of singing a song. Mm-hmm. So he can't say anything. So like in the 2 seconds of silence between lines, he would yell out that they have to stop turning the floodlights on. And he did that three or four times, and they kept turning the floodlights on. So eventually, he flips over an entire piano and storms off stage.
Wow, he got superhuman strength.
Yes. And you don't expect it from Billy Joel.
No.
And he was doing it to protect the kids and to make it a good show.
You better if he flipped the piano onto them.
Onto them. Teaching them about crowd surfing the hard way. One more thing about Buddy Rich before we move on. He was famous for having rivalries with other people. There was another jazz musician named Max Roach. And Max was walking down the street. And Buddy Rich, according to legend, pulls up in a convertible with his arm around a beautiful woman and yells out, "Hey, Max, top this!" And then drives off. He doesn't seem like the classiest sort of guy. Also having a death day this week. Buddy Rich was born 100 years ago this week, but Edgar Degas died 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. He was a French painter, one of the famous...
Do you pronounce the S in...
Was it Degas?
I think it was Degas.
Okay.
But what if I'm wrong? I don't know.
No, that sounds better. I'm normally very good with my French pronunciation. But
no, you're not.
No, I'm not.
No. There have been many times throughout the show where... I haven't said a word about it, but no, I think you're good.
Oh, I definitely think I'm good.
No, you're not.
Okay, so this is the Dunning-Kruger thing, where if I think I'm good, I'm either deluding myself or I'm right. And you're telling me that I'm not right.
No, you're
that I'm
you're,
wrong.
I don't have good French pronunciation, and even I know that you're wrong.
Okay, so Edgar Degas?
Yeah.
Leave off the last S for savings?
Yes.
Okay. So, Edgar Degas was one of the classic impressionists, but he didn't like the word impressionist because that was more of a Monet Renoir thing of painting blobs of paint, and then when you stand back, you see what it is.
See, whereas comedians who are impressionists, they like that.
They do.
They don't like when you call it imitations.
No.
It's an impression. They'll correct you.
I like to call it Travelinaism. People get very upset when I say that, except for Fred Travelina, who loves it.
Mm-hmm. He's a big listener of ours.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a friend of Monet, of Seurat, of Pizarro, of Cézanne, of Renoir. Did I do well with those pronunciations?
Not bad.
Not bad. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. He died at 83 years old. One of his favorite topics was ballet dancers. He had lots of paintings of ballet dancers. And one of his ballet dancers has a cameo, I found out, in Night at the Museum 2. If I remember the scene right...
I haven't seen this one.
You haven't seen it? Because the museum comes alive, they go into like a place with paintings and photographs, and they're able to jump into the paintings and photographs, and each one is like a different portal to another world.
I didn't know there was a sequel to Night at the Museum.
Well, there's two sequels. Well, they each go to different places and meet new and different statues.
Is it all different museums?
Different museums, yeah. The second one's in the Smithsonian, and the third one is in the London Art Museum. Or whatever their giant fake museum is called. Because I don't think they actually called it the real museum. I'm not good with my British museums. I don't know which one it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was the real one and they filmed it and I'm just too stupid to know.
Yeah.
I'm assuming they did.
I've never seen any of these movies.
Wow, I thought you would have.
No.
No? In a couple of years, you will. Because there's monkeys slapping people. And at around 5 or 6, it's the funniest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And around 7, it stops being funny. And then you don't have to watch it every weekend. But soon the monkey slapping will begin.
In addition to painting lots of ballet dancers, he painted a lot of nudes. He was one of the first people to really popularize the idea of painting nude women. And in his later years, that was all he wanted to do, just surround himself with young nude women. And I'm pretty sure he basically was a dirty old man at that
point. Yeah, sounds like it. So I'm guessing like it was just like really badly done drawings too, you know? Yeah. Didn't really try very hard.
Now, all of the poses are different and the perspectives are different, but they all have one thing in common, which is that it looks like all the women had been sitting down like 1 second ago and you asked them to stand up. And they're in the awkward process of trying to stand mm-hmm. up. And your body moves just a little bit differently every single time you do this.
There were no strip clubs back then.
No, there were like the can-can clubs.
So if you wanted to see a naked woman regularly, I feel like you had to learn to paint. Like, I'm guessing that was actually probably the motivator for most men who developed artistic yeah. skill.
Either that or move to Tahiti and then paint.
Yeah.
And then say, well, since there's all these naked women around, I guess I'll just have to paint them. Here, can you hold these oranges? I'm going to paint oranges. I would get a basket, but you just hold the basket.
So I'm guessing most of these painters were just, they're perverts.
Yes. Yes. I think painter and pervert were basically the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me think about someone like Jackson Pollock. He just decided he has a whole new way of being perverted.
What if that was actually... His paintings of naked women look like that. He's just a shitty artist who wanted an excuse to like have naked women in front of him.
A woman posing for like 4 months and then shows, so this is what I made.
Just spins around the canvas.
Or he had a blank canvas until like 10 minutes before, and then he sees like a squirt bottle of ketchup and a squirt bottle of mustard. He's like, it's so crazy, it just might work.
He's looking for a way out of here. Oh, yeah, no, this is my style.
This is definitely on purpose.
See a spot over there? Oh, that's your nipple.
And this represents the 20th century. He was he lived during the Belle Epoque era, which was like the 1890s. And instead of saying Night of the Museum should be our... Nickelodeon for the week. I'm going to go classy. I'm going to say Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, because Midnight in Paris is...
I thought you were going to say, a little classy, Night Museum 3.
No, there's not any in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet. That's where Night of Museum 4 will go, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But in Midnight in Paris, Owen Wilson's character is able to wander around at midnight and walk into the past of Paris, which is the 1930s.
Yeah.
And he sees all these great people, hardly any of them French.
Ernie Hemingway there.
He meets Ernest Hemingway. Yeah. He meets the Spanish Surrealist painter. I can't remember his name right now. But he meets a whole bunch of interesting people, none of them French. And they're all talking about their past golden age of Paris, which is the Belle Epoque era of like 40 years before. And at the very end, they go back in time even more. It's like Inception, basically, mm-hmm. where they travel in the past and then travel further in the past. So you get a little bit of can-can dancing. Oh, I should have just said Moulin Rouge. This is a long way around. So
how many Nickelodeons we have this week?
I should have just said Moulin
Stay Rouge. Stay in, just watch movie after movie. Yeah. Du Nez Museum, Moulin Rouge.
It'll be an interesting triple feature. Night of the Museum 2, Midnight in Paris, and Moulin Rouge. One of these does not belong with the others. So maybe you should sandwich that one in the middle. Night of the Museum 2 in between the classy films. Do you want to hear some quotes from Edgar Degas, which will make you change your way of thinking about him?
Sure.
Okay. Quote number one, which is right on the money. Everyone has talent at 25. The difficulty is to have it at 50. Now, I think that quote has a lot of truth to it, but I'd be very interested to find out how old he was when he said it.
I also don't think everybody has talent at 25. There's plenty of untalented people at 25.
Yeah, but maybe when he said everyone, I don't think he meant everyone. I think he meant everyone who is a talented person.
Yes, you're just not going to say hold on to that talent.
Right. Right, just the same way that it's much easier to be beautiful at 25 than it is at 50,
mm-hmm.
because it's just one of the
things. Yeah, I feel like, as I've gotten older, I feel like if you're like 25 and unattractive, you got no excuse.
But maybe you could turn things around. Like, you know, there's lots of character actors that didn't get jobs until they turned into their 30s and 40s, and they were able to be cast as adults
mm-hmm.
instead of just weird-looking man-children. Okay, second quote. Truth is never ugly when one can find in it what one needs.
And?
That, yeah. Yeah, and the third one, the one that's
been... That's more fortune cookie than,
yeah.
than deep.
Maybe it sounds better in the original French.
Yeah.
And the third quote, art is vice. And this ties in a lot with your idea of a dirty old man.
Mm-hmm.
You don't marry it legitimately, you rape it.
Oh.
So that's where he stands.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm imagining him saying these things to the woman he wants to, like, pose for him. And, like, most everyone's saying no. And every once in a while, someone's like, as long as I get some hair on money, I'm okay. You can say whatever you want. Just don't leave any marks. So, our big story this week is on food riots. Did you know that there were a whole series of food riots going on during 1917?
No, I didn't.
No?
No.
Oh. Maybe because I didn't tell you.
I only know what you tell me. I know nothing else.
Do you know what happens after 1917?
1918?
Yes. But you knew that.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay, so you know something. So the first of the 1917 food riots happened in New York City in February 20th. There was a mob confronted stores and pushcart owners over the raising of prices following shortages in World War I. This is one of the consequences of war, that the prices of everything goes up.
There's less available.
Yeah. I always imagine that the shipping of food overseas had something to do with it, partly because I'm imagining U-boats sinking it, because they always talk about U-boats sinking, like, tonnages. Like, that's how you talk about how successful a U-boat is, the amount of tons of cargo it sinks. And I'm imagining it was always often grain. I can't imagine anything other than just tankers full of grain.
Just wheat and rice just floating around the ocean.
Yeah.
You're right. That is always the whenever they talk about a U-boat, that's always the stat they give.
Tonnage. And I don't know how they would know. And are they just good at estimating? Like, they send a torpedo, they hear something blow up, and then they surface and they just start looking at, like, how much grain is floating on the top, and, like, what do you think? 31 tons? 32 tons?
There may have been, like, you know, shipments of feathers coming in.
Or maybe they just had, like, a wither scale put strategically at the bottom of the ocean, and then when it lands, they just
weigh it in.
Yeah. Yeah, they just look, 31 and a half tons. Okay.
That's the most likely.
I think that would
be our guess.
I think that would make sense. So, the food riots of 1917 precipitated a boycott campaign all around the country. It eventually forced down the prices of people selling food at pushcarts. That was like an action point where you could very actionably not buy a hot dog from this one guy mm-hmm. and say, you're charging too much for a hot dog.
Or you can wreck a cart more easily in the store.
Yeah, and it's obviously one guy running a cart. Mm-hmm. It's not a whole bunch of people. It's not like you could go into a Christie supermarket and make an effect by the charging in and saying, I'm not going to buy anything here, and then leaving. No one would.
They wouldn't really care yet.
No.
You went with Christie as the example. I like that.
I did.
Yeah, because you didn't go with ShopRite, you didn't go with Pathmark.
It's only in New York City that I've seen Christie. I would be shocked if they existed anywhere outside.
Yeah, I think they're only there, yeah.
Yeah. And I never liked that whole idea, because I've only been in a couple, because I've never lived in New York. But the prices and the sizes of the packages, I'm always horrified, and I didn't realize how much you'd have to change your way of, like, shopping in order to live in New York.
My father-in-law lives in the city.
Oh yeah.
And whenever he comes to visit us, he does his food shopping over here.
Ah.
And brings it back.
Because you can't get a box of Cheerios.
Sometimes
three servings.
U-boats sink his car.
Oh, that's too bad.
A tonnage of groceries lost there. No, you're right. He does. He shops. He gets everything. All his stuff here.
Yeah. And it's not like you get a small box of Cheerios for $3, and you come here, you get a big box for $5. You in Gristiti's, you get a small box for $5. Mm-hmm. And if you come here, you get the big box for $5.
No, when, you know, my wife's from Brooklyn. Uh-huh. When we met, we talked about whether we live in Jersey or Brooklyn. I said, these grocery stores, too small. I feel like I'm going to knock things over. I can't move about freely in them.
It doesn't feel like a real grocery store.
No.
No, it feels like a very large bodega.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there's anything in there, it's just a coincidence that it happens to be what you want. Like, a bodega has two types of cereal, and then that's it. And, you know, it's on your head that you decided to buy food in a bodega in the first place. So what are you expecting? And I feel that's the same thing in the supermarket.
Yeah, grocery stores, that was my big argument. I don't care about the arts and culture. I want to be able to buy in bulk.
In the Netherlands, there was a separate food riot. There was something called the Potato Riots. This started in January of 1917. That was when the bread ration began, because you need some sort of starch. Mm-hmm. But after 6 months of that, it moved over to the potato side of things. I think, despite the fact that I'm Irish and, you know, Irish have the potato stuff, I'd easily give up potatoes over bread.
Same here.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like, you know, we never have a sandwich again.
Yeah. Well, what about potato rolls? Is that count as both? How much potato is in a potato?
I'm guessing not much.
No.
Like a hint of potato.
I feel like it would be a terrible experiment to just grind up a potato and add
and try to turn it into bread.
Yeah, try to bake it and then see what comes out. Like, this is not remotely potato bread. I feel like I could do the same thing with rice cakes. Mm-hmm. I could take some wet rice, I could put it in the oven, and it would not turn into a rice cake.
It would just be burned rice.
It would just be burned rice.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some sort of magic going on to make potato bread and rice cakes.
You've thought about making your own rice cakes, haven't you?
Yes. Every year, in fact, I think about making acorn flour, because we have an oak tree in the backyard, and there's acorns that fall over the place. And you know what? Screw the squirrels. I want it. It's mine. I'm tired of the squirrels eating my acorns. I'm tired of raking them up and throwing them away.
Well, that's why I've noticed you're storing them in your cheeks as you're sitting here.
I am. I've built up Hardarian pouches to hold them. But there's a trick to making acorn flour, because the reason why we don't eat acorns is they're covered with tannins, which is poisonous to people. So you need to soak the acorns over and over again. In the olden days, you were by a water source, so you just put them in a bag and then put the acorns in a river, and you'd wait 4 hours and you'd be done. But we don't have running water in this world, other than like actual running water.
Which it's going to run water the whole time.
Yeah, which I don't want to do, because even then you're only hitting like one or two acorns. So you need to soak it and take it out and soak it and take it out. But don't put it in like for a day and a half, which is what I did. Because then,
oh, so you've attempted this.
I've attempted this. And the acorns started to germinate, and they started to rot, and they got disgusting. And and I realized I did this wrong. And I think I'm supposed to cook them first, and then grind them up, and then soak them to get rid of the
tannins. How many acorns do you have back there?
Not yet. Not many yet, because it's still early on, and it's been hot.
I think we should have an acorn bread.
An acorn bread off?
Yeah. One episode. I think you should make some acorn bread. We'll have.
I will try it. I've been yelled at every year for attempting it, because all my wife heard was poison, and then she was. There's something about me trying to cook food that might be poison if I got it wrong. That for some reason she thinks I'm going to get it wrong.
I'll give it a shot. You never gave my cigars a shot.
No,
and you're never going to, are you?
Probably not.
No, I didn't think so.
But you know, let's save the acorn flour for the last episode, because if you die, then I'm out of a co-host for the rest of the year. Oh, the Dutch potato riot culminated in a battle on July 15th, 1917. Soldiers opened fire on a crowd that had gathered at the Harlem Merplin, which is where Harlem came from.
Yeah. Merplin? Is that what you said? Merplin?
Harlem Merplin. Yeah.
Merplin? What's a Merplin?
It's the place in Harlem. I'm not up on my Dutchness. The revolt was beaten, but 9 people died and 114 people were wounded.
Well, more food for them.
I'm wondering. I read an article that talked about the difference between a famine and a mere food shortage. A food shortage is what you would think would.
I imagine there's food, but not enough of it to go around. There's not famine. There's just no food.
Famines are apparently more of a man-made thing. Famines are what happen when someone decides to hoard food, and there's not enough for anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can imagine, like, the Walking Dead situation, where there's, like, one guy in a castle with a huge pile of canned goods, and everyone around him is serfs who are, like, starving, that's a famine, where there is food, but it's not being evenly distributed. But
so what, the potato famine in Ireland, was that a famine or a food shortage?
Ooh. Now I'm not sure about my own nomenclature, because a famine would then suggest that someone was controlling it.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. I think you may be wrong on this one. I think you may have it reversed.
Maybe I do have it reversed.
I think you do.
Yeah. Yeah, but there was a salient difference between people not having enough food and like warlords hoarding food. And the potato famine, no one was hoarding food because it was rot. The potatoes were being destroyed. I've never lived in a world without food, not even in like a food desert sort of situation where I have to drive 20 minutes to the
supermarket. No, me neither. I've always lived in very populated areas and a very full fridge.
Yeah. And I keep on deluding myself into thinking that I'd do great in a food ride because I don't need much food.
You know,
but that's not the case.
Yeah, you're not a big eater, though.
It depends upon where I am. I can condition myself in certain places to eat or not eat. Like, if I'm in a place with fancy desserts, I have no problem telling myself I'm not spending $9 on a pastry, and then I just won't have dessert. But if I'm at my desk at work and I know I have like a junk drawer of food, then I can't help but eat it until it's all gone. In fact, I need to start stepping up the pace because the Halloween candy is coming in just 1 month's time.
Yeah, you need to make room.
I need to make room, and I need to get rid of the last vestiges of the Easter candy.
I always make sure I buy the Halloween candy that I like because what's left over, I get it all.
That's a very good rule. Some people try to do the opposite with the idea in mind that then it's easier for them to drop it all off and say, here, co-workers, just take all of these good and plenties.
Do you dress up for Halloween still?
Yeah.
You do. I remember you being bringing, we talked about you were trick-or-treating well into college.
Yes.
You
love to bring that up.
Yeah.
Yes, I haven't trick-or-treated in a long time. I have kids now, so
you go with them trick-or-treating.
I go with them.
Yeah. But you still dress up for Halloween every year.
Yes.
But like, what do you do at work? So you just like sit at your desk?
Well, I work with my wife. So because of that, we decided to do joint costumes. Last year was very easy because we went as Amy and Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory, which in practice means I just wear a Star Trek t-shirt and then a long t-shirt underneath that, and I just jeans. So that almost looked like no costume at all, and unless people thought, well, he doesn't normally wear that sort of t-shirt at work. I'm thinking of something else this year, but it'll be more elaborate. I can't do any sort of Disney bounding. Do you know what Disney bounding means?
No, it sounds like some sort of big bondage kind of thing.
I recently learned this phrase, and I may be using it wrong, but
famine.
Like famine, yes. Disney bounding means when you dress up using your own clothes to emulate someone else in a distinct outfit. So, you don't have a Superman outfit, I'm guessing.
No.
But you may have a blue shirt, and you have blue pants, and you have red socks. So you could put those on, and you kind of emulate Superman just a little bit.
Where's bounding? What's the...
I don't know where the bounding comes from. Maybe it has to do with, like, you would dress up like your favorite character if you're bound to go to Disney.
Mm-hmm.
But most all of my Halloween costumes have been a variant Disney bounding, where I don't want to buy anything. I want to use my existing clothes and find a way of making it seem like it's a Halloween
costume. So you have an idea of what you're going to be this year.
Yes, but because it's a joint costume with Cindy, I'd have to actually get
I did not know you guys worked together.
Oh, yeah.
When did this start?
Yeah, we started about 2 years ago.
Huh.
Yep. They were looking for copywriters at my work, and I suggested her, and I got a referral fee, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get a referral fee at my company if you suggest someone and they hire that person.
Yeah.
But you need to wait 6 months before the referral fee kicks in. So you can't just hire some schmo and then have them not work out.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make sure they work out.
Which, you know, that would suck if it's your wife, because then, like, you're losing income in the house.
Yeah.
And you don't get your referral fee.
Yes. But now, I was very worried when she started to work that she would find me out for the fraud and fake that I was. But we don't work together, so far that hasn't happened.
You're in the same building.
But we're in the same building, and occasionally we're in a meeting together.
And on Halloween, you have to stand next to each other, so it makes sense.
Yeah. In years past, though, they had someone who was taking everyone in costumes pictures and then sent them out to the company. They didn't do that last year. So the whole idea of having a joint costume was to, like, have everyone see the costume. But we'd have to individually go up to everyone in the at work and say, look, it's us.
See, you know who we are? That's why I would never dress up in costume and go to work, because it just feels like... I'm not a Halloween guy. I'm totally about this. But
yeah.
I feel something about costume parties. You put on a costume, and then what do? Like, it's like you're in a... Like, oh, look at you. All right, look at you.
Yeah.
Now what do? We just keep looking at each other? Like, you know, like, it just seems, like, weird to me.
It is especially weird if you have a regular day at work, and you sit down at your desk, and you just happen to have scissors for hands.
That happened, didn't it?
Yeah, I was Edward Scissorhands 1 year. And I kept on taking off my gloves and taking off and putting on my glasses so that I could type. But then if someone wanted to take a picture, I felt like I needed to be in character. So I needed to take the glasses off and then put the gloves back on. And it's hard to put on scissorhand gloves because, you know, they're full of scissors. And you definitely can't type with them.
How was there not a memo that came out immediately following of no costumes next year?
Because people want to have a fun work environment.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that means low productivity on the day of Halloween, if you're going to have a Halloween party.
So, yeah, dressing up is just basically a way for us to not work much.
Yeah. Yeah. We could pay for this party, but instead we're just going to ask you to dress up.
So what's the costume going to be this year?
I don't quite want to say, because I haven't really talked to Cindy about it.
Really?
Yeah. But
you bet. Is it going to be Disney? Is it a Disney
thing? No, it's not a Disney thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure if I'll actually go through with it. But I do need to decide somewhat soon.
Just say what you're thinking of.
Well, see, like 2 years ago, I went as Wolverine, but I needed to grow out my sideburns for that, which meant I grew a full beard for a month just so that I could shave it off, save for the sideburns.
You don't grow facial hair that quickly, do you?
I grow it at a regular pace, but I also shave every day.
Yeah, I've never seen you with a beard.
Yeah. My kids don't like it at all. Not one bit.
No.
Every day, they just look at me in the eye and say, shave. Daddy, shave. And my brother, Sean, has a beard right now. So I think they've established
he's the beard guy.
He's the beard guy, and I'm not the beard guy. Right. And if I get a beard, it's as weird as if he doesn't have a beard.
Mm-hmm.
And with him without a beard is like, you know, Tom Selleck without the mustache. It's just, oh, this is... Don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I thought about shaving my beard because I have some gray coming in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's like too much face. Got all the face going on.
Now, were you one of those people that grew the beard at first because you wanted to keep the goatee, but then you just wanted the goatee to expand? Or was it...
I wanted a jawline.
You wanted a jawline. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But you're not doing, like, the chin strap thing.
No. That's weird for adults.
Yeah. That seems like a lot of work, though.
So what's the costume, Jeff?
Yeah.
Tell me.
I feel like I haven't pulled the trigger on
it yet. You're a bad broadcaster if you don't say what it is.
So, moving on.
Really?
I'm sure we'll.
Why wouldn't you say it? Is it offensive? Is it like about like blackface or something?
Well, first of all, that's not offensive at all if you do it in the right spirit. definitely not offensive.
I always think about every year there's one like celebrity who has to apologize. like one celebrity who doesn't know about this yet.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a member of the British royal family.
Yeah,
Sometimes it's a reality star. But there's always one person who thought, you know what? I'm the sort of guy, it's not just that I can say the N-word and I'm not racist. I can put on blackface and I'm not racist.
Yeah, it's always like, I was unaware of the ramifications. They just have to give like a really sincere apology about it.
I had no idea that dressing up like Hitler would be seen as offensive. I apologize to those if they were offended. I did not mean to offend anyone when I dressed up as Hitler. And I'm saying it, I'm just now realized you had me dressed as Hitler.
I was about to mention, but I had a TV project in college, and Jeff played Hitler.
So our quiz this week is on Red Auerbach, the Boston Celtics legend. Okay, question number one. Red Auerbach was called that because he had red hair and a fiery temper growing up. What was his real name?
I don't know. Herman.
Arnold. Arnold. Close. Herman and Arnold are very, very similar to
each other. The names that like, people don't really have anymore.
Right. And they just sound vaguely, vaguely German. What would Red Auerbach do when he thought that his team had clinched a win?
Light up a cigar.
Yes!
Which is something that you should be doing.
That I should be doing, yeah. But we haven't clinched a win yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm imagining he's doing this like at the end of the third quarter. just to rub it in, like, you guys have no chance. We're putting in our second stringers. We're pulling out anyone who's going to be playing tomorrow. We're not even trying. We'll give you three baskets. I'm just going to smoke this cigar and wait for the...
I didn't even smoke a cigar on the bench during a basketball game. Just light up a stogie in the middle of the game.
It was a slightly different time back then. And he was not the only person smoking. Imagine a room full of 30,000 people and they're all smoking.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't even see.
No.
That does explain some of those old black and white grainy photos
they look great too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can imagine that caked in smell of smoke. Mm-hmm. Like even when everyone's gone the next morning, it's still heavy with smoke.
Well, you see like boxing photos. It looks like a cloud actually. It actually looks like a cloud over the ring.
Yeah. Auerbach was famous for drafting the first black player into the NBA. Who did he draft? Do you remember the guy's name?
No, I mean, Bill Russell was the big one there, right?
Yeah.
It was Bill Russell. It's not Bill Russell, right?
No, it's not Bill Russell. First, literally the big one because he's like 7'2".
Yeah.
But no, the first drafted black player was Chuck Cooper.
Okay.
And he had a chance of drafting someone else, but he purposely didn't draft this guy in 1950 because he felt the player was too flashy. Which white player did he think was too flashy to draft? It's one of these like 1950s legends, like Jerry West.
I don't know.
Bob Cousy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Which NBA award is called the Red Auerbach Trophy?
Probably, what, like the Coach of the Year award?
Coach of the Year, yeah. I'm not sure how Coach of the Year works, because presumably... If you won, you'd be the coach.
I think you go with the idea, like, it's like MVP. Yeah, MVP maybe you think would be on the winning team, but if you're like the best, if you're on a team as an average team,
yeah,
and you've carried them further than they should go,
mm-hmm.
or if you're a coach who's coaching a team that's, maybe the personnel is not there, but you do well anyway, or you made necessary changes through injuries, whatever,
right.
You could be coach of the year, and you've done, it's about doing better than you should and making improvements.
I guess if I think about it from like the Oscars or Emmys point of view, the person who wins Best Director isn't necessarily the same person who wins Best Movie. Because you can be the best directed film of the year, you can have the best performance, and it may not be the best film of the year. Mm-hmm. There's some movies that are really, really hard to put together, but they still don't work as well as something where just the magic was there.
Yeah.
Just because you did the work didn't, and the magic wasn't as there, didn't mean that you shouldn't be rewarded for it. Newt Rockne famously brought passing into the college football game. What did Red Auerbach bring to basketball?
Let's see. I'm
proud of this question, especially because I'm not that much of a sportsman.
It wasn't the full court press. It wasn't him.
No. No, it was the fast break.
Okay, all right. No.
His big thing was that if you get three people to run as fast as they can past half court to the other side and they've got the ball, at most you can have two defenders there and you know, do man-on-man coverage and throw the ball to the guy who doesn't have anyone on him, and he gets an easy layup.
Yeah. I know nothing about basketball, just, you know.
No?
No, it's not my sport. I know baseball. We did baseball quiz. Let's do baseball quiz.
Yeah. Well, I thought Red Auerbach was a baseball player up until when I started this quiz.
Really?
Yes. Before the NBA was created, Red Auerbach coached for the Washington Capitals in the Basketball Association of America, the BAA. Who uses the Washington Capitals name now?
It's a hockey team.
It's a hockey team, yeah. I just realized as I was reading that question, the answer to the question of who uses the Washington Capitals name now is the Washington Capitals.
Yeah. Yeah,
you could have answered that without knowing the real
thing. That's like the Grant's Tomb type question. Yeah. No, because the basketball team was the originally was the Washington Bullets,
mm-hmm.
but there was too many real Washington Bullets, so
then they changed the Wizards. It to Washington Wizards.
Yeah.
Auerbach began coaching with the Tri-City Blackhawks of Moline, Illinois, which sounds like a basketball team comprised of like 11 people, and there's another 9 in the stands. That team, believe it or not, is still around now. It's been bounced around from town to town. What is it called? The Tri-City Blackhawks of Moline, Illinois.
Oh, they're like a minor league team?
No, they are an NBA team.
Hmm. Let's see. I'm trying to think. Moline, Illinois. Would they be the Chicago Bulls now?
No, they are the Atlanta Hawks.
Okay, yeah.
They kept the name and they just shortened the Hawks, it.
Yeah.
And originally they were the Buffalo Bisons.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea that these teams can move around so easily. Going from Buffalo to some nowhere place in Illinois to all the way down to Atlanta. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason.
Why were they big enough to have a major league sports team?
Maybe someone had built a stadium or an arena there, and they're like, well, we have an arena, and it's 45 minutes outside of Chicago, so let's just assume that people from Chicago will go there. And if not, we'll just go to Atlanta, and we'll just keep on caravanning around the country until we find a place that wants us. Final question. What year did he join the Boston Celtics as an organization? It ends in a zero.
1950.
Yes, you got it. And with that zero, that's also the end of the 1917 podcast for this week. Join us next week when we jump into October. Until then, ahoy hoy.
Ahoy hoy.